Seattle likes to think of itself as a progressive place, but it has a complicated history to reckon with. One chapter of that story is set in North Seattle at a roadside restaurant owned by a guy named Maxon Lester Graham. It was called the Coon Chicken Inn, and its whole brand was based on a racist stereotype of African Americans. But back in the 1930s, very few Seattleites took much issue with the restaurant. Catherine Roth wrote about the Coon Chicken Inn for a civil rights history project, and she filled this in.
It was sort of just a very basic building, but the entrance is what was remarkable. It was this giant head that you would walk through the mouth to get into this restaurant, and it was of a caricature of an African-American male known as the Coon, wearing a porter's hat, really enlarged lips, smiling and winking. The character of the Coon, or the caricature of the Coon, dates back to the 19th century minstrel shows with this character named Zip Coon, who became really popular in northern cities, especially in the post-Civil War years, where white northerners were really kind of scared and uncomfortable with the, you know, liberation of black people and the migration of black people to northern cities, and used minstrelsy and used all of these racist imagery as ways to reinforce white supremacy, sort of provide some comfort of superiority for working class whites, especially.
And for patrons, once they walked through the head, like what would they have seen and so on after that?
Right. Yeah. So the menu was also this giant logo. So the image was everywhere. It was prevalent throughout the restaurant. And I think the original advertisement when they opened in the Seattle Times was how it was served from a mammy. So this is another example of just like reinforcing this black stereotype of like black people know how to serve chicken. And here we have this authentic fried chicken for you from the South, even though the owners were from Salt Lake City. For black Seattleites, this was extremely problematic.
And what was the kind of racial backdrop of the Seattle area at this time? We're talking about the late 20s. How integrated or segregated was this part of town? And where were we in the kind of arc of racial segregation here at that time?
Seattle is extremely segregated. So there were these lines in property deeds called racially restrictive covenants that kind of stipulated who could and could not live in certain neighborhoods and in certain places. So this is something that you would find in pretty much every North Seattle neighborhood, and people of color in the Seattle area were really restricted in what neighborhoods they could live in. So you see the rise of what became the Central District or the or Chinatown or parts of South Seattle that were places that people of color were permitted to live based on property deeds.
So there was this kind of beacon of racism just north of town, pretty far away from the areas where African Americans were permitted to buy and rent homes. How did the imagery and the presence of this place infiltrate the rest of the region?
So Lester Graham offered a delivery service, and he had a few delivery cars that really boldly displayed the logo on the sides of the car. If you look at the advertisements, they say they'll deliver to any part of the city and like all day until 2 a.m. So this was an opportunity for this image to travel throughout Seattle.
Wow. And then it wasn't just the delivery cars too, right? He had these like these tire covers.
This is another big gimmick he used to advertise. So Lester Graham ordered thousands of these spare tire covers to be put on people's spare tires on the back of their cars. And I think he gave them away as sort of a gimmicky advertising stunt. So people would actually, I think of like the Jack in the Box jack that you used to put on top of an antenna like back in the 90s or something like that. That I think that's sort of the idea, that this was a way to just get the logo out there and get free
the
advertising.
Burger King crown.
Yes, exactly. So people use this, and people would put these on the back of their cars and drive around with this image.
Wow. What are some of the ways that African Americans and anti-racist groups at the time registered their displeasure?
So one story of resistance to this image was this guy, Joseph Staton, who talked in this oral history interview back in the 1970s about how him and a couple of his friends decided to have this contest to sort of protest the spare tire cover logo. And they put 50 cents into a pot and decided that at the end of 30 days, whoever could cut out the most tire covers or the logo of the tire cover would win the pot.
Cut, and what do you mean cut out?
Like physically with a knife, like go and cut out this coon head logo.
So they would see a car with the cover on it. They would take a knife, cut it out, and
they would take this knife, cut it out, and then go away with it. So sort of this vandalism to protest. And he was actually arrested and booked for this vandalism. And the story goes that he when he was in front of the judge asked to see whatever he cut out, and he showed them the tire cover, and the judge supposedly laughed and fined him $3.
Implying that the judge was at least somewhat sympathetic.
Right, at least aware that this was sort of an understandable act of resistance, vandalism.
Yeah. So besides these individual acts of protest, were there anything more organized?
Yes, definitely. There was a really focused and organized civil rights movement in the 30s. And in 1930, basically as soon as the Coon Chicken Inn opened, they filed a complaint against the restaurant for defamation of race and were trying to get the Coon Chicken Inn to change their logo and their form of advertising.
Yeah. Well, how effective were the protests against Coon Chicken Inn?
So initially, they had a slight victory in that Lester Graham agreed to cut out the spare tire covers to stop producing them and to change the color of the logo.
What did it look like after they made those changes?
Right. So by 1931, the Northwest Enterprise published that they were again pursuing the Coon Chicken Inn because they were still producing these tire covers, and they had changed the color of the logo to red, but that this was still a really prevalent image and that this was problematic. By 1930,
it still looked very much like the coon head, right?
I mean, it was still like, so by 1932, the logo was turned blue. So if you look at like later productions of this logo, it's still obviously blackface and still obviously this caricature, but it just happens to be this shade of blue and it doesn't say the word coon on it. So that was their way to avoid a lawsuit, but it was still very clear what the message was.
And you write about this overall kind of white indifference to the really offensive dimension of this restaurant. What can you tell us about that? And what does it say about the particular characteristics of racism and racial prejudice in the Northwest?
Yeah, white Seattleites were very indifferent to this image, and I think were much more concerned with class issues at the time than they were with race issues. I think it just shows that there were a lot of racial tensions in the Northwest, and the Northwest was this deeply prejudiced place. And Seattle, we like to think of ourselves as this like very liberal city with this liberal history, and a lot of people don't really understand just how deeply rooted racism is in this region.
Well, what role did those protests play in the eventual demise of this restaurant?
I mean, this is the tragedy of the push for civil rights in the 1930s and 1940s, is that this was sort of like a unsuccessful resistance. I mean, it was successful and they removed some of these tire cover logos, or they got the color of the logo changed to blue from black and the word coon erased from the teeth. But really, like, the image remained, and it remained a very popular restaurant. And it never closed because of the protests. Nothing really changed because of the protests. So the restaurant ended up closing in the late 1940s because of a decision by Lester Graham to turn it into an army surplus store instead.
And that is sort of somehow deeply unsatisfying.
Absolutely.
Was there ever any kind of vindication then for the protesters?
I mean, maybe the personal satisfaction of knowing that you like removed this logo from someone's car, but you know, not really. It was sort of this, I think the Northwest Enterprise, the black newspaper, after the lawsuit in 1932, their articles like Coon Chicken and Dodge's lawsuit. So basically, no, there was no satisfactory ending for resisting this logo. It remained.
Yeah. So looking back on it, I mean, what do you think that we have to learn from this episode of Seattle's history?
I mean, I think that the Kuntjaginin really was this beacon of bigotry that existed in North Seattle during the 30s and 40s, and really provides a interesting window to look into the racial dynamics of the city at the time. And just to be reminded that the city was a deeply segregated and deeply racist place during the 20th century, first half of the 20th century. And the legacy of these racially restrictive covenants, the legacy of the sort of cultural racism of this Kuntjaginin logo still remain. And it's something that we actively need to be working on as a city.